And then I pull out my card because I'm thinking, you know, these computers could fix themselves at any time. So I had to be prepared to pay, you know?
For sure.
So I try to hand him the card and he's like, no, don't worry. It's on us. Our computers are down. Just have a great night.
Wow.
And Ann says, well, in that case, I'll have the filet mignon. And literally everybody around us starts laughing and was like, it was a great time. I was like, I've been trying to crack jokes for like 10 minutes up in here and nobody said anything.
See, dad jokes don't work.
The mom jokes go over like awesome.
In a world where you only have trailers and posters to judge a movie, Jim and Ted strike out to answer the age-old question, will you see it?
Ted. Episode 66, I feel so lonely. We've been together with other people for a couple of weeks, and now it's just me and you again, sweetheart.
That's right, the two of us.
Yeah, just the two of us.
Oh, hi, Clarissa.
Well, Clarissa is here because she wants to try the beer, and she doesn't have headphones or anything, so she can't hear anything.
All right.
Let's just jump into the beer right away.
Let's do it.
Okay. So Clarissa works with a guy who does physical therapy, and he made his very first homebrew.
That is awesome. And you guys are going to drink it on the pod tonight.
And shared it with me to drink on this on tonight's episode. I mean, I got to say, this dude has cojones. Because I know my very first brew was like drinkable at best. And, you know, I can't say I would have trusted anyone. And essentially when it's like, you know, Derelict, who we're going to be doing his review. And then like this guy has big brass balls. Like, I don't know where, I think the two coincide somewhere. I don't know how that overlaps, but. Anyway, let me open this here, and I'll pour it, and then both Clarissa and I are going to try it, and I'll give my, you know, I'll be nice. I mean, I have no idea what to expect. It's like a dude's first homebrew ever. It could be awful. I don't even know.
This is very exciting. Are you going to give his name only after you know whether it's good or not, or?
Well, his name is Aaron Poirier.
Oh, he's got a beer. A beer name.
Yeah. P-O-I-R-E-R. Poirier? Aaron Poirier, I guess. I don't know. Whatever.
Okay,
but I mean, not whatever. I mean, it's the guy's name, but you know, it's like, but hey, I'll tell you what though. I don't care how this beer is. Just the mere fact he gives me a beer to do on the show is like amazing. Anyway, here we go.
Awesome.
I'm just hoping it's not flat.
There we go.
Okay. We have CO2.
There you go.
There we go. ASMR. Oh, it looks good. Oh, it smells amazing.
Bubbles.
Wow. It's.
What was the expectation? How did he describe it to you?
I know nothing. Clarissa just brought it home. Oh my God. It smells amazing. Wow. It's dark. Good head. Pretty good. Not bad.
Amazing.
Not bad. It's good. Yeah. Man, I only wish my first beer was this good. No, I'm serious. Like, this is no shtick, you know? It's like...
Good job.
The only thing I would say is it's slightly oxidized.
Oh, what does that mean?
So what that means is somewhere in the after fermentation process, oxygen got imparted into the beer somehow, like maybe through splashing or something like that.
What does that do to the taste?
It makes it taste like wet cardboard.
Ah. That's not good.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I would say though it's minor. I mean, in all reality, it is slightly oxidized. Overall though, it's not bad. I mean, you know, it's very minimal, but I would say overall, like especially for your first beer, that's the easiest thing to fix, you know, is oxidation, because all you have to do is just be more careful in just how you handle your beer, really. Overall, though, I mean, you take away the oxidation. Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's really good.
Minimal notes.
Yeah, and I have no idea the IBU or the ABV or any of that kind of stuff. But taste-wise, though, flavor, oh, it's great. You know, it's clean. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit hazy, but it probably just needs to settle more to clear up the haze.
Hey, it's an IPA, you know, haze is en vogue, so.
Well, I don't think it's a hazy IPA. I think it's hazy just because it's probably a little bit young.
Okay.
If it just sat for longer, it would probably clear out better.
Mm.
But yeah, I would just say be more cautious on after the fermentation and just try not to splash and try not to get any oxygen in there. And otherwise, it's good. I mean, it's great, actually, you know?
So you ferment it in a larger container? What is it like considered a keg and then you put it to bottles?
Well, I'm not sure how he did his.
You're typical, how you typically do it.
But I would say though, like for myself, I use a carboy, and a carboy is like a glass version of, you know, like a Sparklets drinking bottle, you know, those 5 gallon bottles. That's a carboy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I do, you know, but I have glass ones, and what you do pretty much is you get it into there. So you brew it, you know, you get it into there. How you get it into there, I mean, there's some nuance, but to avoid the nuance, you get it into there and then you oxygenate it. I use a bottle of oxygen with a stone, an oxygenation stone. You could use like a type of stone for aquariums, but the bubbles are too big. You know what I mean? So you waste a lot of oxygen. You want to get that like really, I forget how many microns mine is. It's like really tiny.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But you do that and you just get the oxygen, like it's the oxyacetylene kind of oxygen for torches that you get at like Home Depot.
But the food grade level?
No.
Oh, this is different.
No, there's not food grade. There's like construction. I don't know, construction grade or I don't know what you call it versus like medical grade. Oh, and medical grade's like you need like a prescription to get medical grade.
I see.
So you just go to Home Depot and get, you know, just oxygen in the red bottle. But anyway, you want to put oxygen in before it ferments because that helps you get your yeast all lively and ass kicking, right? However, once it's fermented, you want oxygen to come nowhere close to your beer because then it oxidizes and gets that wet cardboard flavor.
I see.
And with this one, I could say I do taste a little bit of the oxidation. For first beer, awesome. Like I said, mine probably wasn't half as good as this for my first. But aside from that, though, you know, you just have to be cautious and careful on how you handle your beer after it ferments. And but like I said, that's an easy fix, though. Like, you know, as an off flavor goes, you don't want to do things like bleach because then that's going to give you like a wet Band-Aid flavor.
Ugh.
Well, you chew on wet Band-Aids. You know what they taste like, right?
Only by accident.
Exactly. But no, and there's other flavors that you just, you know, like if you have a keg with dirty lines, you get bad flavors. You know, if you boil with the lid on, you get these, what do they call them? Like acetyl. I can't remember what they call them. But you get like these weird flavors that come in, like if you boil with a lid on and stuff. There's all this weird stuff that can impart, you know?
But if you're into pica, then maybe you like the wet cardboard and the wet Band-Aids taste.
Exactly. Know? Just go out the backyard, just throw some dirt in the mouth and, you know. Anyway, what are you drinking tonight?
Okay, cool. So tonight I did not go down. So this week was our spring break or my children's spring break. So I took the week off from work, which means I didn't go down to Burbank. We actually did a little traveling, but I'll get into that a little bit later. But I got the beer this week from Cost Plus World Market. And I was standing in front of the beer wall there because they also have a very extensive collection. And a woman came out and her name is Christine. Oh, see another Perling. So Christine Perling is the wine and beer buyer at this Cost Plus World Market. And she also has a wine tasting company and event planning. So if you want to do wine tastings at your private party, that's kind of a cool thing to do, I thought. But she suggested a bunch of beers.
So are Cost Plus World Markets, are they independently curated and stuff? Or
it seems like they are. They're part of the Bed Bath & Beyond overarching brand of stores.
Yeah, that I knew. But to say that one woman is like for the one store. I mean, that's,
yeah,
that seems, wow, that's pretty impressive actually.
Right? It's nice. So she gets to select all the wines and we had a nice discussion with her about rosés and different kinds of wines. But I went with a different kind of stone and I was actually, we were traveling down to San Diego. We were doing some missions around this local area and I wanted to get a San Diego beer. And I had a couple of beer places picked out, but I didn't get to them. I'll explain that a little later. But I did pick up a Stone anyway, and I went with a Stone Espresso Totalitarian Imperial Russian Stout.
Wait, Espresso Totalitarian Imperial Russian Stout?
Yes. See it?
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
So it's a mouthful. Let's see how it tastes.
Tastes like a mouthful, I'm sure. So the funny thing is, you tell me like we can't record Friday because you're going to be at Spring Break Mission or something. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what the heck's your mission? And then after looking at Instagram all week, I'm like, oh, they're going to missions. I get it.
All right. So again, beautiful head.
Wow. That is like a chocolate head there. That is amazing.
Beautiful Stella Artois glass. Thank you for...
Dude, I'm so jealous.
Oh, yeah. So espresso is right. It's a total package Imperial Stout. It is 10.6 APV. And it's a stout. So the stouts don't have that same IBUs, right? Or do they have IBUs anyway?
Stouts tend to be a higher IBU. Like 70 to 80, depending. But yet when you look at all the, you know, the grains and the alcohol and stuff, it tends to like mellow them. I mean, you know, the bottom line with beer is whether it's alcohol, your bittering, or, you know, your like whatever your flavor is, your hops and all this stuff. I mean, a well-balanced beer is going to be well-balanced. And even if it's high in IBUs, you're not really, it's not going to like destroy you on bitter, let's say, you know, because there's a balance to it.
Right. It's amazing how much the taste of coffee goes with the stout, and then everything just blends. Like everything is heightened in this. So I feel like it feels like it's smooth, but that just might be because of the acidity of the espresso in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I got you. Anyway. So how was your week?
Amazing week.
Oh my God. Let me hear.
Yeah. So Anne always puts together great spring breaks and things like that. So this week was no different. I took the week off from work to be with the fam.
Oh, okay, cool.
And we did the Antelope Valley on Tuesday. I forget, Monday or Tuesday. I think Tuesday.
Yeah.
And that was because Bryce had, we thought that he had an audition on Wednesday. It turns out on Tuesday, we found out that the audition was kind of canceled. So we were able to go out on Wednesday. And then we had Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all planned out to hit five missions down south of here. So there's a mission directly like 15 minutes away. We're going to start there and then head down all the way to San Diego. And we had five missions on the slate for the 3 days. I had a couple of breweries I wanted to go to around San Diego, Point Loma, which is one of the peninsulas right around San Diego.
Yeah.
So we had a 3-day itinerary that we mapped out and did the whole thing. And my brother-in-law and sister-in-law live in Escondido. So we're going to stay with them kind of close to San Diego. And then halfway down, we do a couple of missions, and Anne gets an email that Bryce has an audition on Thursday.
Oh.
So that means, you know, we have Wednesday to do, and then Thursday we can do a couple things, but we have to be back, you know, by, you know, early afternoon on Thursday to audition for a show. But we didn't book out because we knew we were going to be local and we were going to be reachable. And this is kind of why we didn't book out. Booking out is when you tell the agents and stuff that you're on vacation.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So they don't schedule for auditions, but we're like, you know, hey, we'll figure this out. And if either of them get a call for an audition, we'll just come back to town because we're close, you know? So we cut our trip short a little bit. We still hit four missions. And I will tell you that the difference in upkeep of the missions is amazing. The disparity between the best kept mission and the least upkept mission is amazing. Like there's only 21 missions. They're all independently run and funded. And the whole time I was thinking, like the San Fernando mission that we went to first, and then every mission south until we hit San Juan Capistrano was of a different, very, very different stage of upkeep. And I'm just thinking, and different price, you know, like from $5 a person to, you know, I think $20 a person. And I was like, this is amazing. How can it be this different when there's only 21 missions? It seems like they should be regulated or in some kind of association. And as I was looking into it, I said, Ann, next year, 2020, in Monterey, there's a gathering of all the missions. They come together and they have some kind of They have an annual conference of missions. And I'm like, and we're going to the annual conference in 2020 and we're going to tell them they need to put together a package, you know, make a passport book where you check off the 21 missions and you do a group rate because I would love to just pay once.
Oh, kind of like how when you go to the state parks and you get in, like the kids can get badges and...
Yeah, something like that. And then, you know...
Yeah.
And we kind of level out the pricing a little bit. And for the San Juan, and for every San Juan Capistrano, let's throw a couple bucks to the, you know, the lesser missions to get them, you know, a little more upkeep and a little more funding. You know, I think there's a little socialism among these 21 missions that we can kind of foster. So that's my mission for 2020.
Your mission is the mission. No, so all of the missions are functional and still operational, though, correct?
Well, most of them are museums.
Well, right. They're all museums, but I mean, they do have services and things.
Exactly. Everyone has a level of entry and different ways of raising funds within itself. You know, San Juan Capistrano, like I said, I think that one was $15 an adult and $13 per child. But it has, it's a huge piece of land. It has these great exhibits within it. Bryce and I spent half an hour basket weaving, you know, like the Native Americans in there, whole kid station. So it was amazing. And then there's some that were really small. And the one that I liked, the San Miguel Archangel, it was at the time of the missions, it had funded and it had supplied a lot of the other missions in the area with the tallow, the candles, and wine.
Gotcha.
But now it's a little run down and it just needs a little more love and care. And I think, you know, some weeding and some more upkeep. And I think it would be an amazing, I mean, they're all amazing because of the historical relevance and the history of California. And every fourth grader in California has done the mission projects.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's part of the reason we did it. Bryce was there, so he was getting a lot of props for being there. And Audrey did it when she was in fourth grade. So it's kind of amazing that it's such a California staple of elementary school, and yet there's more to learn. You have a mission right near you.
Yeah, and I was going to say, so you have the San Fernando mission about a 15-minute drive away. We have the La Purisima mission, which is about like a 1 mile walk away. So the La Purisima mission grounds, it's a huge, like, I don't know how many square miles it is. If I had to guess, 10 square miles. I mean, that's not really big, but it's pretty big. And there's a lot of stuff going on the grounds there, like hiking, mountain biking, and trail running, and, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they also have, it's a state park, and I think it's the only mission that's not a serviceable running Catholic church, like,
oh, okay,
with services, right?
So there's no church attached to it.
Well, there's a sanctuary and everything, but it's more of a museum, though. So, like, it's not an operational, functioning church.
Right, okay.
Right? Where, like, San Fernando Mission still holds services on Sunday.
That's right. We're going tomorrow. Yeah.
Exactly. So where the the La Purisima mission, what they do is it's a state park. It's a historic state park. And, you know, there's like the rangers there and they have like the housing for the rangers so they can live on the property and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they have like mission days where it's like live like a mission person, you know, whatever it is, you know. And we go to some of them. I mean, they have like the candlelight dinner mission night and stuff. It's like, you know, $50 a person. It's not really cheap. But at the same time, though, like you go, you get a good meal. You have people in character doing mission days. They have the Spanish in the Spanish uniforms, like doing musket training. And it's like, you know, they just kind of, it's all staged, of course. And they have them in like what mission people would have done for that time. There's a museum. They have the CCC, which is the Civilian Conservation Corps. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole exhibit about how they rebuilt the mission at La Purisima, you know, in the 1930s because, you know, earthquakes and all these things. And they wound up moving the mission and they, you know, it's a whole historic thing. It's very cool. And the thing that's most cool is like, you know, from my house, I can go on like a trail run and like just land at the front door in like 20 minutes, you know? So it's like really close, you know what I mean? So, and then, you know, it's just in the grounds and everything is like wilderness. And I mean, it's really a cool place to have so close to home, especially when the boys start to get older. We can just walk and be on these trails and like all kinds of stuff, you know?
Is there an entry fee on that mission?
Parking only.
Okay. So we're walking from your house. Then we don't have to worry about that.
Well, but you know, what's funny though, is I think it's like, so there's a lot of trails that people go from town. It's right outside of the town, you know, like if you're driving from the center of Lompoc, it's like 6 minutes. I mean, like 8 minutes. It's not far, you know, by car.
Right.
But what a lot of people do is they park on the outside of the gate, so they save their $6. Well, but here's my complaint, though, about the state and how the state handles it. So what they do is it's like $6 or $8. And I forget what it is to get in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the locals want to go and like just go walk on the trails and do the stuff they do like for a Saturday morning. And you see people out there all the time, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, $6, $8. I don't even know what it is. It's around whatever. Let's just say $6. Like,
yeah.
But if you're going to go three times a week, I mean, at the end of the year, that's like real money, right?
Yeah.
But why don't they offer to like a Lompoc resident or something, you know, like the local people, why don't they offer like an annual pass, parking pass, to say, you know, like $50, let's say, and you could come here all year as much as you want.
Yeah.
They don't. It's like,
well, it's so funny because San Juan Capistrano, it has like the highest ticket price, like I said, but we paid whatever, 30, I forget what we paid, but for an extra $10 or so, we got a discounted $50 annual pass. So it's amazing. It allows the four of us, the family of four, to go in all year long, whenever we want. So we didn't have to worry about finishing. We got about a quarter of the way through their audio presentation. And I was fine with basket weaving because we can come back whenever we want. And, you know, like you said, if you're a local, you would just do that because there's a lot to do there and it's part of your just routine and a fun thing to do. You know, the kids were looking at this crazy bird trying to get fish out of the pond or something like that. So, you know, it was a nice thing to have. So this is part of what I was talking about, just a way to unify all of that, you know, instead of you could pay $50 for an annual pass to any one of the missions.
Totally.
And then if you guys are on a mission, like you say, other than your fourth graders are free. You know, that's what they do at all the state parks. You know, the state parks, you get a fourth grader pass and the fourth grader gets in for free and the family has to pay or something like that. So I think you could pay $100 and say, I want to go to all 21 missions this year. I'm going to pay $100 to get into all of them. And that's money well spent. And if I don't get to all of them, so be it. You know what I mean? You still get a donation of $100.
And they all share the cost and the burden, right? So,
yeah.
No, I couldn't agree more with that because I think to myself, like, everybody parks outside the gate and the mission gets zero.
Yeah.
But man, come on, give us like, you know, a $50 annual pass. People could park in the gate. They make money. Everybody's happy. But if you pay $6 a day every time you go, you'll be broke. I mean, but then anyway, to end mission talk with Jim and Ted.
All right, so we had a review last week.
Yeah, we did.
A couple weeks ago.
Amazing. Yeah, a couple weeks ago, March 7th. So we're, what's today's date? Today's date is March 20th. So about 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's March 23rd. And it is from Zoolander fan. Derelict 88.
I can derelict my own balls. Thank you very much.
Trailer Junkies sets itself apart from other cinema podcasts with professional and witty insight into the world of movies, specifically marketing. It's fun, insightful, and easy to listen to. The hosts share a passion for film, and it comes through with this show. I think so. We have a passion.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thank you, Derelict.
Derelict!
Yeah, the guy, you know, and Ted brought it to my attention about Zoolander because I didn't pick up on it at first, but
oh, I love Zoolander.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. All right, Ted. Once upon a time in Hollywood.
So it's very excited. We have Quentin Tarantino's 9th movie. Just dropped a trailer on us this week. Columbia Pictures. I love the old title card for the studio. It is a Sony company. And what are your initial reactions to it?
Okay, initial reaction.
Yeah.
Like straight up, if you say once upon a time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I was thinking like the golden age, 1930s to 1960, right? So, you know, if you think about it in those terms, title-wise, the other thing is like Tarantino's only made 9 movies. It seems like so many more, doesn't it?
And to me, it seems like so many more. And not only that, it's kind of, why are we talking about the number of movies that he's made, you know?
Why are we counting?
Yeah, why are we counting? I think Anne found in subsequent articles that she's been reading about Tarantino, he plans on making 10 movies and then he's retiring.
Oh, I see.
So I think this is the countdown. It is his penultimate movie. And just so we get the definition of penultimate in here.
Yeah, second to last.
It is the second to last. And it is amazing. You know, it's so funny that you said that, because when you think of the golden age of Hollywood, Leo DiCaprio has already made that movie in The Aviator, right? He had The Aviator as Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
They had Man's Chinese Theater for that, you know. So this is a different golden age of Hollywood, the 70s. The Bruce Lee impersonation is by far my favorite thing about this trailer.
It's great.
And then the last scene with Leo holding the gun is probably my favorite moment of the trailer, because it kind of throws trailer convention out. You know, it's kind of, it holds on the actor in a way that is specific to the intimacy of Tarantino and Leo DiCaprio. You know, it's like Tarantino trusts Leo with his movie so much that he'll let Leo go places in emotional journey, and he'll even draw it out in the trailer and let it lay there on screen for all of us to feel the bare emotion of the way Leo's depicting something. So Leo's going someplace in his mind where few actors are allowed to tread, but no director, no auteur would trust their actors and be able to pull off and say, no, we're going to leave this in the trailer. I think most other production companies would push around a director, even an auteur, to say, this final scene is kind of extra. We don't need it.
So Ted, can you name his anti-penultimate?
I don't even, what's anti-penultimate? Was that the second movie he made?
No, the third from the last.
Oh.
You know, like third place instead of second place.
Third.
Or third from the end. You know what I mean?
Like, anti-penultimate. That's so weird. That's a weird term. So is there a hyphen in there? Or is it just all run together?
No, but it's also anti and like A-N-T-E.
Oh.
Penultimate. Not I. Not, it's not I. Like anti. It's anti.
Anti-penultimate.
Yeah, anti-penultimate.
What was the last movie he made?
Well, I'm asking you.
Oh, I don't know.
The Hateful Eight.
Ugh. Ugh, okay. Well, I love I love Django. And for me, Django, now that I think about it, Django is the only Western that I will say that I would put in my top 10 movies of all time.
Wait, you'd put a... I might put a Western in the top 10, but...
But it wouldn't be Django Unchained.
I didn't think you'd like any Westerns.
I know. It's kind of... It really is a... To me, it's a Western... In a way that is kind of a, I don't know, it is a Western that is not a caricature of Western, but it is a self-aware Western. So it's not a straightforward Western. I don't think Tarantino makes any movies that are straightforward. I think every movie that Tarantino makes has complete awareness of the genre that they live in and the genre that they occupy, and then the tropes and the treasures and the nuances of that genre. So
yeah,
I think he's such a student of genre that I don't know whether he wants to or whether he can make a genre movie that is a just straight up genre movie.
So knowing Tarantino and kind of how he operates and the gore and the blood and all the stuff he does, and this being a, you know, Sharon Tate murder Manson kind of movie and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Are they going to leave it to the imagination, or is it going to be pretty gory and bloody in your your opinion?
It's hard to say. I mean, I feel like the focus on this trailer is definitely this buddy kind of buddy movie space. So I love the interplay between Leo and Brad.
Well, like when he's going to carry his load. I don't even want to know what that means.
It's such an awesome moment that the two guys should, the three of them, because even the interviewer's in on that joke a little bit.
Yeah.
But it is an amazing moment, and it's kind of sweet in a way, you know? So I don't know. I don't know how they're going to deal with gore. It doesn't feel like a gory movie to me. It feels like he doesn't need, it's not part of this genre that he's exploiting.
So do you think it's going to, excuse me really quick though, but do you think it's going to be close or not even close, but do you think it's going to tell the story of the Manson family and the Sharon Tate murders in an accurate sense? Or is it going to be like left to artistic impression the way Tarantino wants to do?
Yeah, I think to me it feels like the Sharon Tate murder, the Manson thing will be the framing of this story.
Yeah.
But at the core of the story is going to be Leo as an actor playing an actor, you know, which is the self gazing, the belly button gazing that all actors and all and Hollywood. I listen to a lot of podcasts about Oscars and stuff like that. So any movie that talks about Hollywood is kind of catnip for any Oscars or the award season, you know? So it already feels like it has Oscar buzz just by having Tarantino. And I think that's part of the whole ninth movie, you know. This is the second to last time you will get me, you know, to in front of you to give me an award. So I don't know whether that will bode well for him or not, but it definitely feels like it is angling for that. And Leo seems like he's poised to take it as well.
Is there any idea what his 10th movie might be, or does anybody know, or is it like strictly a Tarantino secret?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, this movie was in the works for so long, but he spaces his movies out. He doesn't have to do it, and he doesn't have to make movies, so he can spend time in the marketing and the release, in the care and the pushing out of his baby all the way through, you know, exhibition. So I think that's what he does, and I think he will go back to the drawing board once he's done pushing this baby out.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that kind of upsets me about this movie is like when I see a Leonardo DiCaprio and stuff with wrinkles. You know, I mean, like, are these guys supposed to be that old? I mean, my God, it's like... All that means is I'm getting old.
What do you think back to? What's Eating Gilbert Grape or something? How far back do you follow Leo? Just Titanic?
I would say maybe Titanic, because only reason I say that is we watched Titanic. We started it at about 11 o'clock at night.
Uh-huh.
We were at my cousin Frankie's house. I'm dating Clarissa like maybe a year at that point, and he has it on DVD. And, I don't know. It's like... By the time it ends, it's like 2 a.m, you know, or whatever it was. And I'm just seeing like, what on earth? I think it might be the only time I've ever seen it. I don't even know. But but like Clarissa and the only reason I think about it is because Clarissa and I were dating, and it was, you know, one of those things, you know, those early dating moments that you have.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's Titanic just because of that.
Yeah. I think all the way back to Growing Pains.
Growing Pains.
Yeah.
Where was he in Growing Pains with...
Alan Thicke and Cameron, what's his name?
Yeah. Cameron.
No, Kirk Cameron.
Kirk Cameron, that's what it is. Yeah.
Kirk Cameron. In the later years of Growing Pains, when all the kids were growing up, they brought in Leo as the runaway homeless kid, and they brought him into the family, and the Seavers.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
The Seavers adopted him, and he was trying to steal from their house, and he was like, you know, and Alan Thicke's like, you could rob us or something, but that's not what you need. You need a home, you know? And it was such a, you know, it was kind of a jump the shark moment for the show, but it was Leo's, you know, first scene on air, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow, that's, oh man. Amazing. No, overall, I would say, though, the thing that I like about the trailer is when it starts, you're kind of like, all right, well, let's see what this is about. Mm-hmm. And then it hits that first title card mm-hmm. with the music and everything. And right at that moment, if you knew nothing about anything, you would be like, boom, Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
Like, it just bleeds Tarantino. All right, man. A24 is the last black man in San Francisco.
So this was just an odd trailer that came out this week.
I agree.
I don't know where it sits with me. I love San Francisco. This feels like it has...
Oh, great town.
It feels like it has social commentary, but I love the idea of a house being more than a house and just the life that you live and the things that a house means to a person, especially in your formidable years growing up. So it just feels like it has a huge opportunity to impress, and it has some gravitas with the awards that it's given, awards that it's touting. So it's hard to say that I know what this movie is about by this, but my interest is piqued on wanting to see it. As far as seeing in the theater, I don't think I would see in the theater, but I do love the idea of this movie and what it brings up.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said. I mean, I would say my biggest question about it is they come upon this house that's vacant. They have questions about the house, like who's there, when's the last time you've been there, and all this stuff. It seems to be well kept. It seems that everything about the house is what you would want, you know, something that has some good paint on the walls and all that kind of stuff. And then I have to question, I'm like, well, with the rent prices and the cost of living in LA, they can afford to have an empty house just sitting around?
San Francisco.
Or San Francisco, you're right.
Even more than LA. It's even worse than LA, San Francisco.
With the rent prices in San Francisco, you can afford to have a empty house just sitting around? Like, what?
Well, and it kind of pulls into question when the older woman says to them about the house, how it's not your house, you know? And to me, there's a question of reality. So I don't know whether this house is a stand-in for something or whether there's some kind of level of fantasy that is playing out in this house. It definitely feels like when they talk about throwing parties there and doing things like that, it feels like that they aren't actually doing those things and maybe they're imagining doing those things. But I don't know how far the fantasy goes, whether the house is a stand-in for something else, whether the whole city of San Francisco is the house that these men occupy. So I don't know.
Like squatters in a sense?
Well, no, not even squatters. It's just like the idea, the row house, the painted lady kind of house that they are looking at is so symbolic of San Francisco that it could just be an allegory in and of itself.
Yeah.
For what they're talking about. So it is meant to be a movie. It's meant to have analogies. It's meant to have some representation of what, you know, things are going on, but it could just be part of the fantasy of it. So how deep does a fantasy run? I don't know by this trailer, but I think that's something that is interesting in the portrayal of that space.
Well, and the biggest thing that I took from it, I think, is, you know, San Francisco is so expensive. And we were just talking with some, you know, a couple last night at a party we were at, and they were talking about living in North San Jose and the price, and the wife worked in Redwood City, and he was in, I guess they lived in like East Palo Alto, which is like the ghetto version of Palo Alto, but it's still $1 million homes.
The ghetto with $1 million homes. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, they're all fixer-upper, two-bedroom, one-bath houses for $1 million, but that's the ghetto, you know?
Right, right.
The way they were explaining it and stuff. But anyway, so if you go further north to San Francisco, of course, but it's one of those things where I think it talks about, or it's like the intersection of the crossroad of this, like, extremely expensive community. You know, like, no one can afford to live there yet. you still have impoverished people. You still have people who have been there all this time. They're not going anywhere.
Right.
Whether they become homeless or they just bring more people to live in smaller spaces to pay higher rents, you know, whatever the story is and the allegories that you, you know, get from it and everything. I think that's really the message of this movie is going to be to tell you, you know, in the end that, you know, San Francisco is still a city of people, regardless of the tech industry and regardless of,
right,
you know, how expensive it is. There are still people who wait tables, work in gas stations.
Right.
I mean, it's still a community of if everybody was $250,000 a year software developer, like the whole place would implode because, like, you know, who's bagging your groceries?
I think you're lowballing the price of software developers.
Well, but you get the idea. No, that's the entry level price that I said. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, I get what you're saying. You know, we like Los Gatos and we go up there quite a bit. But it is true. You know, I talk to some people that work at the like Main Street Burgers or something like that, and I'm like, where do you live? And they say like this little town, and it's like it's a little bit on the ways out from there. But they find little pockets. There's all these little pockets of these local places where they can kind of either live with their parents or, you know, live around there and work at a burger joint, you know? So it's hard.
Right.
It's got to be hard to do that when you have these artificial economies building up around you, you know, it kind of locks you into, you know, places that you can't necessarily leave. So I think that's an interesting interplay. It's an interesting thing to try to take on in a movie. So love to see how they do it.
Yeah. I mean, just the overall like socioeconomic stratification,
right,
of like rich and poor and all that stuff. And I mean, it looks like a cool film. I mean, you know, but anyway, speaking of cool films, let's get to Sporks.
Sporks.
Yeah. Toy Story 4.
So Toy Story 4, we did the teaser trailer on another Trailer Junkies podcast, but this week the official trailer came out and it had so much of the story in it. And I just love the idea of, you know, it really follows a Toy Story model of how to build a story. And yet it has found another facet, another angle on the idea of toys. I think the first Toy Story is just the idea of greeting new toys and getting new toys and pulling them into the fold. The second movie is a story of collection and loss. And the third story also, it has a different angle on loss, but also an angle on rebirth. So now we've dealt with these three archetypes of toys within this cinematic universe. And you kind of feel like that's it, you know? You feel like there's a trilogy of stories. You've dealt with the birth in the new, you dealt with loss in the second, and rebirth in the third. What more is there to say about toys coming to life and toys being breathed life by the belief and the imagination of children? And then you have this idea, and you know, we saw Forky in the teaser posters and things like that, and you're like, how central will this character be? And he is the new central character.
He's the main character.
He's what Woody is doing, and Woody is our hero throughout all the movies. But you know, Woody and Buzz's relationship is the main sphere of influence in the first movie. Now Woody is, you know, taking on Forky, and it really is the idea of what makes a toy a toy. Bryce loves origami, so he'll take a piece of paper and fold it and do crazy stuff and make a leaping frog. And it's a toy that he plays with, you know, for weeks, and he has boxes full of folded paper airplanes and folded, you know, he just does tons of origami, and then he's got little teeny origami. And, you know, we went to his classroom at, you know, whatever parent teacher conference.
That's cool.
And inside his desk, he has little teeny origamis, like literally the size of, you know,
like a fingernail,
like a quarter. like smaller than a quarter.
Okay.
But he's done origami with them. And like his teacher is pretty, she's cool. She does a lot of...
She's understanding.
Yeah, she allows a lot of leeway and she understands that this is part of his what he does to rein himself in and kind of cope with whatever is overwhelming him at the moment. But, you know, if he needs a correction, like she'll give him a look. Thank you, Mrs. Carolio, for being a great teacher. She'll give him a look and he'll just walk his little origami. He'll walk it over to her desk and put it on her desk. So she's like, I don't have to do much.
That's funny.
But if he's supposed to be doing math or supposed to be doing reading and I see him doing origami, I'll just give him a second look and he'll usually just walk it over to my desk and put it there. But all that to say, like, I totally get how Bonnie can just like breathe life into a spork, I'm sorry, and create a toy out of it. And then it is completely natural to say that the spork, when it has life, it denies itself the enjoyment of being alive. You know what I mean? So I was like, that's an amazing thing to pull out of a trailer. You know what I mean? For a trailer to show the depth of range of these characters where it seems like a throwaway character and yet he's contemplating existence. And it's like, wow, you're blowing my mind with toys and you've done it three times before, you know? So,
well, and I think you said a throwaway character, but more a throwaway toy.
Exactly.
And the thing that, you know, when you have kids, and maybe people who don't have kids might not be able to relate, but they probably have nieces and nephews and, you know, who knows what, maybe, you know, whatever. But anyway, the thing that I noticed about having kids, especially when, you know, your kids are like 2 and 3 and 4 years old and so on, when they get older, it gets a little bit different, but you could give them, like, I remember it said we got a thing around Christmas time and it was like the Grinch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was an Amazon box and it said the toy your kid's gonna love or the toy you're gonna love or it said something or I'm the toy you're gonna love or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And you open up the box and you're expecting the toy they're going to love, but whatever came in the box is irrelevant because the box is the toy they're going to love.
Yeah.
And I also have pictures of my kids and stuff and video and whatever, you know, that parents do. And like, there's a pie tin and like the pie tin is the thing. And the thing is like pushed to the side. You know, whatever the toy is gets like, well, I don't want that piece of crap. You know, I got a pie tin, you know, and like the pie tin's the thing. The cardboard box is the thing. So to say like a spork is the thing, like totally believable.
Yeah.
Because kids operate in that realm of I don't need the shiny, like, you know, 2020 IMAX Supra 5K, whatever. They don't even care what the specs are.
Right.
You know, it's just like, wow, here's this thing and there's like a Cheerio glued to it. Wow, this is the coolest thing I've ever had.
Right. It's amazing.
And that's what I found, like, just what I loved about it so much is, you know, and what I think kids are going to tie to is that they're going to, even if they're older, right, they're going to remember like, oh, this is a spork, but I remember my pie tin, you know, and like, they're going to be sentimental for that thing, that cardboard box that they, you know, whatever it is. Like, I think kids are going to just totally melt into this. And I think adults will do the same because adults kind of get what their kids do, even if they're so far removed from their own childhood.
No, it's relatable.
Oh, 100%.
It's untread space in the toy world. You know, it's almost anti-consumerism. You know what I mean? Like every,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I gotcha.
Everything has been kind of like a throwback. You see the Fisher Price telephone that I remember from my childhood.
Right.
The first three movies and
keep playing with it, you know?
Right. And it's like, and this is like, it doesn't have to be bought to be a toy, you know? So I love the idea. And then we have other juxtaposition with Ducky and what the duck and the chick, you know, Key and Peele. So when they're in the, and oh yeah, in the carnival or the festival or whatever that is, the state fair that they're at is amazing.
Right.
And do they always have to be the creepiest? There's always some creepy section in these movies. I love the idea of the antique store where they find Bo Peep and she's like taken over this whole space. And it's, you know, I think it goes many different places that we love. So I'm all in on this.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with you. I agree. I mean, it's right there with you, you know, as far as...
Do you think it's too scary for your boys?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think a year ago, probably, they've seen the other Toy Stories. I think Toy Story, which was the one with all the whole wall of Buzz Lightyear.
I think that's the second one.
Okay, that one kind of freaked them out a little bit. I have no idea why, but it did.
Mm.
Other than that, I think they've been okay with all of them.
Because Spike has, you know, the kid in the first one that mangles all of his toys and rebuilds all of his toys.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of a weird one. And then, you know, there's an incinerator in the third one, you know what I mean? So there's scary parts in all of them, but it just heightens the whole drama of the situation. So,
and it looks like the scary part in this one is when she gets like thrown from the train or something, you know, the Sporky or whatever, right? I don't know. We'll find out, I guess, but
yeah, I think Bo Peep in that antique shop looks pretty scary.
Yeah. All right, Ted, what have you been watching now?
All right, so this week we had a great viewing. I rented some things. I watched some stuff, but on Friday...
Wait, on Mission Week?
On Mission Week, I still rented a couple of movies thinking I'd have some time.
Dude, you're like amazing.
Well, okay, so I watched Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, or whatever that was.
Okay.
It was all right. Not huge. I'm a fan of the line, and, you know, we love Blue. We all are big fans of Blue.
Have you found more hours in the day that I'm not aware of?
Yeah, it's called midnight to 2 a.m.
Oh, so you're just giving up sleep. Got ya.
But on, so last night, you know, we had, Audrey had a party that she had to go to. There's Audrey had a party that she wanted to go to. There was a bunch of her girlfriends from school. So we took her to that and we're like, oh, well, let's give Bryce something to do while she's at this party. We won't just go home. We'll actually go out for an evening. So we went to Arclight down in Hollywood and we saw Apollo 11. You know, we hit it up on Common Sense Media.
Oh yeah.
Common Sense Media said it's a +5 adventure. You know, like any kid over 5 can watch this documentary about the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was amazing. So we get to the Arclight, and the Arclight is iconic. You know what I mean? You're in the Hollywood Arclight.
Sure.
And from the beginning scenes, well, some of the establishing shots in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
It has the Arclight in the front end of it, that Cinerama thing. You know, that Cinerama sign. So we're driving.
Oh, man.
We're driving by that Cinerama sign, and we'd park in there, and we'd go up, and we had a couple of gift cards. So we're cashing our gift cards, and the cashier was like, oh, my computer just blanked out. And...
So it's you, Anne, and Bryce?
Right, just the three of us.
And Audrey's with her gal friends. Yeah, okay.
Audrey's with her girlfriends, yeah, doing pizza and karaoke and whatever, you know, 13-year-old girls do at a party.
Sure.
But we get there and the cashier's like, oh, my computer's blinked out. You'll have to use the computer next, you know, my coworker next to me. So I make the obligatory dad joke. I'm like, oh, I guess it's free, you know, and he doesn't laugh and nobody laughs. And I'm like, oh, that sucks. So the guy next to him, he was able to scan us through and I paid $9 on top of the gift cards we had.
Yeah.
And then they're like, go upstairs. So we go upstairs and concessions. And I'm like, well, I only spent $9 to get three of us into the Arclight, which is probably like $50 normally.
Wow.
So I was like, all right, well, let's get some concessions. And we're going to go get some beer and some, you know, there's a little kid combo pack. And I was like, all right, Bryce, get the kid combo pack. And then, and get your...
Like, what's the kid combo pack?
It's like a small popcorn, small soda, and a little snack, like a little, you know, little gummies or something like that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
$7. I was like, that's decent for, you know, for concessions. And then I was like, let's do a IPA. There's a delicious stone IPA there. So I had that. And I was going to go for the smaller one, the 12 ouncer.
Beer at the movies. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Beer at the movies. So I was going to go, oh no, it was a 16 ounce or a 24 ounce. I'm like, let's just do 16 ounce because it's kind of expensive. And Anne was going to get a wine. And I heard the person next to me, and the person next to me was getting their food. And the woman said, well, it's on us because the computers are down. And I was like, uh-oh, I think I'm going to go for that 24-ounce, Ed. I think you should get the big wine.
Wait. Who said it's on us? The concession person?
The concession woman next to us was telling the people, like, right next to us that she was going to give them all of their food, you know?
Wow.
So I said, he said, what size beer would you like? I was like, the 24-ounce, please. Give me the big beer. And then Ann got, you know, Ann was just going to get the small wine because that's all she wanted. I was like, no, get the big wine.
Yeah.
But we were gonna just get what we were gonna get, but only gonna upsize it, you know? And then I pull out my card because I'm thinking, you know, these computers could fix themselves at any time. So I had to be prepared to pay, you know?
For sure.
So I try to hand him the card and he's like, no, don't worry. It's on us. Our computers are down. Just have a great night.
Wow.
And Ann says, well, in that case, I'll have the filet mignon. And literally everybody around us starts laughing and was like, it was a great time. I was like, I've been trying to crack jokes for like 10 minutes up in here and nobody said anything.
See, dad jokes don't work.
The mom jokes go over like awesome.
Exactly.
But, so we get into the theater and it's amazing. The 70mm crystal clear found footage has audio sync to flight command, you know, command Houston control. And then on top of that, Bryce is telling me things about the Saturn V missions that I didn't know about. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a little person. And
he learned it in school?
He's learned it on his own or, you know, through school, some kind of project somewhere.
That's cool.
And then he's bringing me information that I didn't know because I know some stuff about Saturn 11, but it's before my time and it really didn't feel...
Apollo 11.
I'm sorry. Yeah. The Saturn V rocket, but Apollo.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
all the Apollo missions. So
sure.
He knows stuff about different Apollo missions and it was an amazing thing. And kind of when it blasts off, I looked at him rather than looking at the screen and it just like seeing those kind of moments are moments that you as a parent don't have a chance to experience a lot, you know? So I took that.
Was the sound just incredible?
The sound was okay. It wasn't a huge theater, but I was glad to see it in a movie theater. You know, it was better than seeing it at home. And then as the credits started to roll, I turned to Ann. I said, now we got to go rent First Man.
You know? Yeah, for sure.
So we did that and we rented First Man last night and we started to watch it at like midnight. And Ann's like, you're falling asleep. I'm falling asleep. Let's watch it. So we watched it today.
Okay.
And it too has a lot of great scenes in it. And very moving. But I feel a little bad for Damien Chazelle's characters because he doesn't give them a lot of joy to hold on to. You know what I mean? He's so heavy with all of his characters. It's kind of an amazing thing to continue to make movies about sadness and the depth of sadness that his characters have. So, but definitely both worth viewing. And then I have Castle Rock, which is the Hulu series, but I don't know if I'm going to have time to watch that. So that's on deck.
All right.
How about you? What you been watching?
Well, we watched Formula One Drive to Survive.
Oh, you did. It's a series. Did you know that now?
It's a series, yeah. So what I would say is, like, it's a snoozer.
Oh, no.
Only reason I say that is, like, I think it would be better served as just, like, an hour and a half docu and be done.
Yeah.
So reason I say that is because the people who are into Formula One and who know the racers, who know the teams and everything, oh, they're going to love it.
Yeah.
They're going to love it because they do a deep dive on each of the teams. They get into it and they go to all the races around the world. And I mean, they totally like, it's totally deep. Someone like myself, you know, and Clarissa... superficial, you know, we went to the Formula One at, or I don't even know if it's Formula One. I think it is in Long Beach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go there, you watch the cars, you're like, yeah, that was cool. Okay. But you're not really like a fan. You know what I mean?
You're not fully invested in it.
You're not invested. You don't know who the people are and everything. And what you've come to find is like each episode is like a deep dive on like a team.
Oh, neat.
Well, after a few teams, you're just like, oh my God. God, really? Another team, you know, like it's just one team after it, you just don't even care anymore. And we didn't even finish. We got like three episodes in.
And that's it.
And we were just like, all right, I saw one episode. I seen them all. You know, it's done. I think on someone like myself, an hour and a half documentary, I'd sit through the whole thing. It could tell me all I need to know about Formula One. Maybe I'd want to go find out more. Somebody who's like a fan of Formula One, this is who this is for. It's not for me.
Right.
You know, we've also done, since we've talked last, Iron Man 3 and Thor Dark World.
Cool. Did you like that?
Iron Man 3. Let's start there.
Uh-huh.
Completely lost.
Well, you were sleeping through most of it. You said last week.
Oh, I did talk about it last week. Okay. Well,
you said we woke up and Clarissa had to fill you in on what you're missing. And then.
Oh, okay. I did talk about that. So. I must have been sleeping through last episode. Yeah. So I won't, you know, just to briefly recap, I didn't know who was in whose suit. So we'll leave that alone. Thor Dark World. Of all of the movies so far, I think the Thors are the ones I like the least.
Ooh.
Because they're so, like, supernatural, you know? Because, like, I don't know, they're gods and they go to Asgard and they do their thing and it's just, there's just too much, like, magic or something and elves and I'm just,
But you like Lord of the Rings, though.
Yeah, I do. However, Lord of the Rings doesn't play in our world either, though.
Right. And I think to me, Dark World, Thor Dark World, is the most Lord of the Rings-ish.
Well, the elves, yeah.
Movies in the, yeah, with the elves and kind of the way that it's set up with the battles. But you're right. The fact that they're trying to cross over into our world and it kind of gives her too much weight, Natalie Portman. I get where you're coming from for that. I think Thor Ragnarok is still one of my favorites, so I can't wait till you get there.
Well, that's coming up. That's coming up. So, oh, you like that one, though.
Thor Ragnarok is top three, I think, of my movies.
Well, of the MCU, you mean?
Of the MCU, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, and there's, well, like, I forget the count, just like 15 of them or something.
I think 20 total. I don't know.
Whatever, but
we're getting more hate reviews on how on Marvel we are.
Yeah, exactly. Wait, you guys are having a Thor podcast and the guy just barely seen it and fell asleep and No, it was funny though. So we're watching it and Clarissa is looking over, making sure I'm still awake.
Yeah.
And I told her, I said, oh, these movies are a struggle for me, you know? And she said, why are they so hard? I said, because, you know, they're just all the same. It's like you got the bad guy wants to blow up the world. You got the hero who tries to save the world. A battle ensues. They leave devastation in their wake. And next thing you know, like they win. And I'm just like, everyone's the same.
Well, the last five movies are definitely different, and I will say I'm looking forward to Endgame, but Infinity War. Did you see Infinity War?
No. We're the farthest I've ever been is Thor Dark World.
Okay, so you've caught up to all the ones you've seen before now.
Oh, we're beyond those movies. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. So I think, you know, starting with Thor Ragnarok, Black Panther, Infinity War, and Captain Marvel, they have all had different elements, and the bad guys in all those movies have had, you know, grains of truth and grains of goodness in what they, in the angle and what they're doing. So I think, you know, we watched a little bit of the Infinity War with the director's audio commentary, and my daughter is, you know, Audrey loves Infinity War because of Spider-Man. But she was so into it. She goes, oh, you could listen to the directors talking over the movie with them. And I was like, oh yeah. So we watched the first 10 minutes of it and Bryce is 9 and he's like, this is destroying the movie for me. I do not want to watch it like this. So at one point I was like so proud of her that she would want to embrace this and kind of hear about the filmmaking and hear about the storytelling and how the Russo brothers wanted to tell the story. And basically they tell it from using Thanos as the protagonist. So the bad guy is actually the main character and through line for that whole movie.
Yeah.
You know, and Killmonger has a good idea in Black Panther. So I think those are interesting items to get to, and you kind of have to wade through the rest of it and just know that all those stones and the Tesseract and everything that they talk about will all come together with Infinity War.
Well, they talked about the Infinity Stones and all that. Yeah.
Infinity Stones are definitely getting discussed. I look forward to hearing more. I think once you get through the Guardians of the Galaxies, to me, the Guardians of the Galaxies starts a better phase. You know, Ant-Man is definitely a comedic break to the whole idea of good guys versus bad guys, but it definitely goes new places after Thor Dark World.
And I would say the one thing that I do, or that I have enjoyed at this point too, is when they go back and they say, hey, I saw you in New York, you know, yeah. And like the Battle of New York, and they talk about that and stuff. What I hope as they move forward is if they do go back to New York, they don't show just a pristine New York like it was never touched, you know, like an right. untouched New York. It's like, well, no, you guys destroyed New York. You can't have a well-built, back, put-together New York like it was never touched. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me, you know?
Right, right. Well, it's so funny because in Spider-Man, they'll use the cleanup of New York as part of the impetus for the whole movie. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
And then an Age of Ultron becomes the main catalyst behind Civil War. So they're definitely becoming more woven. Now that you have a lot of these origin stories and kind of you've gotten up and running and all these other storylines, now that they start to come together, Age of Ultron you haven't seen yet, right?
No. Haven't seen that one.
So they, in some of the documentaries around Infinity War, they talk about how they've introduced characters in every one of these movies. So the movies where they don't introduce characters are really kind of the set pieces where they really get to express the interconnectedness of all of the characters. So it is a tapestry to say the least, and it is beautifully woven.
And what I love too, though, is that these things are probably like 6 years ago and people are probably rolling their eyes right now. Like, what the hell is Jim Todd? Like, what? You know? But hey, you know, it's like that's where you go when you're looking at like 20 some odd movies in a genre and, you know, in a linear story that just keeps going movie after movie after movie.
Right.
If you like, I can't just jump in at the last one. You got to get all those in so you know what the heck they're talking about, right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right, Ted. All I know is Don Cheadle, he's like in every suit. You know, so.
Only because Terrence Howard wouldn't pony up to come back.
That's right. All right, man.
All right, man.
Hey, you have a good night.
You too.
All right, bye.
Next week, join Jim and Ted as they disarm another Hollywood bomb or marketing masterpiece. Remember, the holy trinity of podcasting. Subscribe, like, share.
Special thanks to Jeremy Kent Jackson for the voiceover and Rahelio for the music.